the man and the woman can recite the nikah without any witnesses, and they can recite it by themselves, mm-hmm. provided that other conditions are met. Okay.
Oh, what do you mean? What are other conditions?
Other conditions, of course, if a girl is virgin, if a girl is dependent in the matters of her life, she should obtain her father's permission or her paternal father's, paternal grandfather's permission.
Mm-hmm.
And without his permission, the marriage is going to be invalid.
Yes.
Okay. A girl, a virgin girl or a dependent girl, okay?
Yes.
A girl is dependent when her father has a say in her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
A girl is dependent when her father...
Even if she's not virgin?
Even if she's not virgin. Even if a girl, for example, has committed adultery, or let's say she has been, she has had an sexual intercourse with another man without nikah,
mm-hmm.
she's still treated as virgin in the eye of Islamic Sharia.
Uh-huh.
She is virgin because she has never been married lawfully in the past. Though she has lost her hymen, and she's no longer virgin medically speaking. Okay, but from the viewpoint of Sharia, she is still regarded as virgin, and therefore she needs her father's permission when willing to, when she wants to get married to someone.
And is it necessary to ask a resident alim, a religious scholar, to say or pronounce the nikah formula?
No, I'm trying to say and to underscore the fact that there's no need for a resident alim or for a scholar to pronounce the nikah. Okay, they can do it. They can recite the nikah themselves. After the woman, okay, gets her father's permission.
As long as they can make sure of the correct pronunciation of the marriage formula, right?
It's not a big deal in the sense that it's very easy to pronounce it.
Yes.
It's very important, first of all, that the two parties to the marriage should initiate the nikah. And their intention of reciting, for example, Zawajtu or Qabiltu, okay?
Yes.
These words which are uttered by the two parties, they should recite it in Arabic first of all, and then the intention is should be to initiate the relationship. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of only reciting, pronouncing the nikah and having no intention. The intention is
important.
An essential part of the nikah.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
And you also mentioned that it should be pronounced in Arabic.
Of course.
So it can't be pronounced in other languages.
You know, Arabic is necessary if the two parties can recite it in Arabic, okay?
Uh-huh.
As I said, it's not very difficult to recite the Arabic formula. It's very easy, and you can learn it in a matter of 1 or 2 minutes. You can read it from the paper, and you can read it. If you cannot read from the paper, you can read the transliteration.
Yes.
The transliteration. And, of course, if none of this is possible and the two parties feel they cannot recite it correctly, they can recite the formula in their own language, provided that it gives the same meaning And it has, yes.
Under the same intention.
And it's coupled with the same intention, of course. Mm-hmm. The meaning should be the same. The intention should be the same.
And is there any difference between permanent and temporary marriages here?
It doesn't make any difference. Both of them can be recited in Arabic, and also in case of inability.
Right.
Inability, they can recite it in their own language, provided that it should have the same structure and the same meaning, and should give the same meaning.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about matrimony, is it possible or is it permissible for a husband, actually a man, to see and talk to his fiancée?
Well, it depends from one situation to another, okay?
Right.
If a man wants to see his fiance in the presence of her parents or in a gathering of family members, there's no problem, okay?
Yes.
They can see each other, they can talk to each other. But generally this does not happen, and the two sides want to see each other in private, they want to speak with each other in private, and that is not permissible, because it's very much likely that they might end up falling into a sin. A fiancé is a woman, a would-be wife, okay? A would-be wife who is expected to be the man's wife, the man's wife in the near future, but they have not concluded the nikah, the marriage contract,
mm-hmm.
and so therefore they are non-mahram to each other. As long as they are non-mahram to each other, they cannot treat each other as husband and wife. They cannot consider each other as husband and wife, and they cannot, of course, deal with each other in the same context, and they cannot do what a normal husband and wife do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not permissible for them to express love, to joke with each other, to look at each other with lustful intention, to have physical contact. All of these are forbidden.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajah ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
جلیس بودن خدا مقدمه داره. مقدمه‌اش این است که انسان ذاکر خدا باشه، یاد خدا باشه.
Companionship with Allah needs some prerequisites. The main preface to the love of Allah is remembering Him in any moment and anywhere. If we remember Allah, then He will become our major companion in our life, and if we forget Allah, then the Satan will accompany us. Satan is always tempting us towards corruption. Sometimes, especially for clergymen, corruption is shown by Satan in a lawful manner and face. This will spoil all our positive efforts in life. However, on the other side, Allah invites His servants towards remembrance of Him. He asks His believers to remember Him while obeying and worshipping. In answer to their worships, Allah will remember them by giving them sustenance, bounties, comfort, heaven, and ultimate satisfaction. This is how companionship with Allah works. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khala of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khala of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Stock Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the vice chair of the London Film Critics Circle and chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochrane, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
The game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur,
political strategist,
controversial as you can get,
an incredible capacity for treachery,
win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule: it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest liar, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed.
I revel in your hatred. Because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me, Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all of the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one.
So it just gave
me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I've never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but been involved in countless campaigns, but also we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, he Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So
years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This what was so useful about this film was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say, this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment. And that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon. And we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that. That whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right-wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized. And it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. Mm-hmm. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way? And is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment has been deep dissatisfaction with their years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and mm-hmm. which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows. Roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. No, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it is absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manifa, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when he denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and it's not, they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election, where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back,
yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
Yeah, he knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, the famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
The show that would discredit
part of this,
Trump.
He's part of this, and he's, it's, again, it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stones where he said the NBC is the CNN, actually, they're marginalized now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but are becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme center. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effect, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's a, I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that, the work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is it merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going to win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام عرفت الله سبحانه بفسخ العزائم وحل العقود ونقض الهمم
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, I came to know Allah the Glorified through the breaking of determinations, change of intentions, and losing of courage.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, one of the beautiful things which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, is the fact that there are certain people throughout history of this earth and the history of humanity who have been endowed with a divine kind of knowledge, whether it be individuals like Prophet Musa or Prophet Isa, or for example Prophet Maryam, Lady Mary, Prophet Zechariah, and of course the Holy Prophet, the 12 divinely appointed Imams. These are individuals who clearly history has witnessed were endowed with a divine knowledge, a special and unique knowledge on behalf of Allah, because they were worthy and capable of this kind of knowledge. And so we find when we talk about Imam Ali alayhi salam and this kind of knowledge, knowledge of the unseen, knowledge of future events, knowledge of even the past, which we have not delved into so far, we find that on occasion we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam was addressing Bara ibn Azib. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, my son Hussein will be killed while you are alive, but you will not help him. After the martyrdom
of the Master of Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Bara says, "By Allah, Ali informed me of Husayn's martyrdom. And yes, he was martyred as Ali had foretold, and I did not help him as Ali had foretold." Bara expressed regret as long as he lived following the events of Karbala for not having helped Imam Husayn. We find here again, dear brothers and sisters, this profound lesson that if we are to follow somebody, if we are to follow a religion, if we are to follow an individual, if we are to be the devotees of a certain individual of a religion, then let it be an individual, let it be a religion which is the most perfect religion as far as Allah is concerned. Let us follow an individual who, as far as Allah is concerned, is the closest to Him. Let us follow someone who, as far as Allah is concerned, is the one on the right path, the path which leads to salvation, the path which leads to the satisfaction and acceptance of Allah, the Exalted. And another very subtle point where we conclude the session is that, remember, when Karbala comes around, for Karbala is not an event which is limited to 1,000 years ago, but ever since Karbala, it has been Karbala, an individual Karbala for each and every single one of us. And remember, when that Karbala comes, do not miss the opportunity to help Imam Husayn alayhi salam, for surely it will lead to regret, remorse, and shame for all of eternity. Another profound and deep lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
For the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." For protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Essentially, the position of Ali is the Imam, the divinely appointed leader after the Prophet of Islam. When we look at the Imam appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, one of the most essential qualities which comes with that position is the issue of ilm and knowledge. Not just a normal knowledge we are talking about. Rather, they have this special knowledge which is a gift from Almighty God, where the Wali of Allah, the beloved friend of Allah who has been chosen by God to lead the people, has the access to ilmul ghayb. He has the access to the knowledge that Almighty God has. Of course, he is, absolute. Ilm al-Ghayb is absolutely his, but he, as out of his own will, gives access to those whom he chooses among the leaders that he has appointed for the mankind. When we look at Ali, the name of Imam Ali is actually linked with the concept of knowledge. When we look at the virtues of Ali, for example, in his lifetime as well as, after his martyrdom, it's amazing, it's actually a miracle that although there were so many anti-Alawi forces, there were people against him who talked very negatively about him in his lifetime, and even after him, during the Umayyad era, for a long, long time, they used to tarnish his image. But it is a miracle to see that even in spite of all this anti-Alawi propaganda, if you look at the amount of praise which is there in the Muslim books of history and hadith, none can come even close to the praise which is there for Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zayd al-Salami.
We spoke about a variety of things in the previous episode, making sure that, you know, we stay away from prolonging our sitting in the bathroom,